listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. Last show, we were looking at the chapter Biology and Belief. Section today is Emotions, Feeling the Language of Cells. In higher, more aware life forms, the brain developed a specialization that enabled the whole community to tune into the status of its regulatory signals. The evolution of the limbic system provided a unique mechanism that converted the chemical communication signals into sensations that could be experienced by all of the cells in the community. Our conscious mind experiences these signals as emotions. The conscious mind not only reads the flow of cellular coordinating signals that comprise the body's mind, it can also generate emotions, which are manifested through the controlled release of regulatory signals by the nervous system. At the same time that I was studying the mechanics of the cell's brain and gaining insight into the operation of the human brain, Candace Pert was studying the human brain and becoming aware of the mechanics of the cell's brain. In the book Molecules of Emotion, Pert revealed how her study of information processing receptors on nerve cell membranes led her to discover that the same neural receptors were present on most, if not all, of the body's cells. Her elegant experiments established that the mind was not focused in the head, but was actually distributed via signal molecules to the whole body. And importantly, her work emphasized that emotions were not only derived through a feedback of the body's environmental information. Through self-consciousness, the mind can use the brain to generate molecules of emotion that override the entire system. While proper use of consciousness can bring health to an ailing body, inappropriate unconscious control of emotions can easily make a healthy body diseased, a topic that will be expanded upon a little later. Molecules of Emotion is a very insightful book describing the scientific discovery process. It also provides some revealing insights into the struggles encountered when trying to introduce new ideas into the science old boys club, a subject with which I am all too familiar. The limbic system offered a major evolutionary advance through its ability to sense and coordinate the flow of behavior-regulating signals within the entire cellular community. As the internal signal system evolved, its greater efficiency enabled the brain to increase in size. Multicellular organisms gained increasingly more cells that were dedicated to responding to an ever wider variety of external environmental signals. While individual cells can respond to simple sensory perceptions such as red, round, aromatic, sweet, etc., the extra brain power available in multicellular animals enables them to combine these simple sensations into a higher level of complexity and perceive an entire system, for example, apple. Fundamental reflex behaviors acquired through evolution are passed on to offspring in the form of genetic-based instincts. The evolution of larger brains with their increased neural cell population offered organisms the opportunity to not only rely on instinctual behavior, but also to learn from their life experiences. The learning of novel reflex behaviors is essentially a product of conditioning. For example, consider the classic example of Pavlov's training his dogs to salivate at the ring of a bell. He first trained them by ringing a bell and coupling that stimulus with an immediate food reward. After a while, he would ring the bell but not offer the food. By that time, the dogs were so programmed to expect food that when the bell rang, they reflexively started to salivate, even though no food was anywhere nearby. This is clearly an unconscious, learned reflex behavior. Reflex behaviors may be as simple as the spontaneous kick of the leg when a mallet taps the knee, or as complex as driving a car at 65 miles an hour on a crowded interstate highway while your conscious mind is fully engaged in conversation with a passenger. Though conditioned behavioral responses may be inordinately complex, they are no-brainers. Though the conditioned learning process, neural pathways between eliciting stimuli and behavioral responses become hardwired to ensure a repetitive pattern. Hardwired patterns are habits. In lower animals, the entire brain is designed to engage in purely habitual responses to stimuli. Pavlov's dogs salivate by reflex, not by deliberate intention. The actions of the subconscious mind are reflexive in nature and are not governed by reason or thinking. Physically, this mind is associated with the activities of all the brain structures that are present in animals that have not evolved self-consciousness. Humans and a number of other higher mammals have evolved a specialized region of the brain associated with thinking, planning, and decision-making called the prefrontal cortex. This portion of the forebrain is apparently the seat of self-consciousness, mind processing as well. The subconscious mind is self-reflective. It is a newly evolved sense organ that observes our own behaviors and emotions. The self-conscious mind also has access to most of the data stored in our long-term memory bank. This is an extremely important feature, allowing our history of life to be considered as we consciously plan our futures. Endowed with the ability to be self-reflective, the self-conscious mind is extremely powerful. It can observe any programmed behavior we are engaged in, evaluate that behavior, and consciously decide to change the program if desired. We can actively choose how to respond to most environmental signals and whether we even want to respond at all. The conscious mind's ability to override the subconscious mind's pre-programmed behaviors is the actual foundation of free will. However, our special gift comes with a special pitfall. While almost all organisms have the actually experienced the stimuli of life firsthand, the human brain's ability to learn perceptions is so advanced that we can actually acquire perceptions indirectly from teachers. Thus, we accept the perceptions of others as truths. Their perceptions become hardwired in our own brains, becoming our truths. Here, however, is where the problem arises. What if our teachers' perceptions are inaccurate? In such cases, our brain are then downloaded with misconceptions. The subconscious mind is strictly a stimulus-response playback device. There is no ghost in that part of the machine to ponder the long-term consequences of the programs in which we engage. The subconscious works only on the now. Consequently, programmed misconceptions in our subconscious mind are not monitored and will habitually engage us in inappropriate and limiting behaviors. If, perhaps, I included as a bonus in this particular chapter a slithering snake that pops out of the page right now, most of you will run from the room and throw the book out of the house. Whoever introduced you to your first snake may have behaved in such a shocking way as to give you your impressionable mind an apparent important life lesson. See snake, snake bad. The subconscious memory system is very partial to rapidly downloading and emphasizing perceptions regarding things in your environment that are threatening to life and limb. If you were taught that snakes are dangerous, any time a snake comes into your proximity, you reflexively, unconsciously engage in a protective response. But what if a herpologist were reading this book and a snake popped out? No doubt, herpologists would not only be intrigued by the snake, but they would actually be thrilled with the bonus included in the book. Or at least, they would be thrilled once they figured out that the book snake was harmless. They would then hold it and watch its behaviors with delight. They would think that your programmed response was an irrational one, because certainly not all snakes are dangerous. In fact, only a small minority are venomous. Further, they would be saddened by the fact that so many people are deprived of the pleasure of studying such interesting creatures. Same snake, same stimulus, yet completely different responses. Our responses to environmental stimuli are indeed controlled by perceptions, and not all of our learned perceptions are accurate. Not all snakes are dangerous. Yes, perception controls biology. But, as we've seen, these perceptions can be true or they can be false. Therefore, we would be more accurate to refer to these controlling perceptions as beliefs. Therefore, beliefs control biology. Ponder for a moment the significance of this information. We have the capacity to consciously evaluate our responses to environmental stimuli and change old responses anytime we desire. Once we deal with the powerful subconscious mind, which I will discuss in more depth in later chapters, we are not stuck with our genes or with our self-defeating behaviors. Joy.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton. We're looking at the chapter Biology and Belief. The next section is How the Mind Controls the Body. My insights into how beliefs control biology are grounded in my studies in cloned endothelial cells, the cells that line the blood vessels. The endothelial cells I grew in culture monitor their world closely and change their behavior based on information they pick up from the environment. When I provided nutrients, the cells would gravitate towards those nutrients with the cellular equivalent of open arms. On the other hand, when I created a toxic environment, the cultured cells would retreat from the stimulus in an effort to wall themselves off from the noxious agents. My research focused on the membrane perception switches that controlled the shift from one behavior to the other. The primary switch I was studying has a protein receptor that responds to histamine, a molecule that the body uses in a way that is equivalent to a local emergency alarm. I found that there were two varieties of these switches, the H1 and the H2, that respond to the same histamine signal. When activated, switches with the H1 histamine receptors evoke a protection response. The type of behavior revealed by cells in toxin-containing cultural dishes. Switches containing H2 histamine receptors evolve a growth response to histamine similar to the behavior of cells cultured in the presence of nutrients. I subsequently learned that the body's system-wide emergency response signal, adrenaline, also has switches sporting two different adrenaline-sensing receptors called alpha and beta. The adrenaline receptors provoke the exact same cell behaviors as those elicited by histamine. When the adrenal alpha receptor is part of the IMP switch, it provokes a protection response when adrenaline is perceived. When the beta receptor is part of the switch, and the same adrenaline signal activates a growth response. All that is obviously very interesting. But the most exciting finding is when I simultaneously introduce both histamine and adrenaline into my tissue cultures, I found that adrenaline signals released by the central nervous system override the influence of histamine signals that are produced locally. This is where the politics of the community described earlier come into play. Suppose that you're working in a bank. The branch manager gives you an order. The CEO walks in and gives the opposite order. Which order would you follow? If you want to keep your job, you'll snap to the CEO's order. There is a similar priority built into our biology, which requires cells to follow instructions from the head honcho nervous system, even if those signals are in conflict with local stimuli. I was very excited by my experience, because I believed that they revealed on the single cell level a truth for multicellular organisms, that the mind, acting via the central nervous system's adrenaline overrides, the body, acting via the local histamine signal. I wanted to spell out the implications of my experiments in my research paper, but my colleagues almost died from apoplexy at the notion of injecting the body-mind connection into a paper about cell biology. So I put in a cryptic comment about understanding the significance of the study, but I couldn't say what that significance was. My colleagues did not want me to include these implications of my research because the mind is not an acceptable biological concept. In fact, bioscientists are conventional Newtonians. If it isn't matter, it doesn't count. The mind is a non-localized energy, therefore is not relevant to materialistic biology. Unfortunately, that perception is a belief that has been proven to be patently incorrect in the quantum mechanical universe. Placebos, or placebos, the belief effect. Every medical student learns, at least in passing, that the mind can affect the body, sometimes in profound ways. They learn that some people get better when they believe, falsely, they're getting medicine. When patients get better by ingesting a sugar pill, the medicine defines it as the placebo effect. My friend Rob Williams, founder of Psych-K, an energy-based psychological treatment system, suggests that it would be more appropriate to refer to it as the perception effect. I call it the belief effect to stress that our perceptions, whether they are accurate or inaccurate, equally impact our behaviors and our bodies. I celebrate the belief effect, which is an amazing testament to the healing ability of the mind-body interaction. However, the all-in-their-minds placebo effect has been linked by traditional medicine to, at worst, quacks, or at best, suggestible patients. The placebo effect is quickly glossed over in medical schools so that students can get to the real tools of modern medicine, like drugs and surgery. In my opinion, this is a giant mistake. The placebo effect should be a major topic of study at medical school. I firmly believe that medical education should train doctors to recognize the power of our internal resources. The problem is, of course, that such reliance on the power of internal resources would not be profitable to the doctor. Doctors should not dismiss the power of the mind as something inferior to the power of chemicals and the scalpel, which they use so eagerly. They should let go of their conviction that the body and its parts are essentially stupid and that we need outside intervention to maintain our health. The placebo effect should be the subject of major, funded, widespread research efforts. If medical researchers could figure out how to leverage the placebo effect, they would hand doctors an efficient, energy-based, side-effect-free tool to treat disease. Energy healers say they already have such tools. But I am a scientist, and I believe that the more we know about the science of the placebo, the better we'll be able to use it in actual clinical medical settings. I believe the reason the mind has so summarily been dismissed in Western medicine is that the result, not only of dogmatic thinking, but also of financial considerations, as mentioned earlier. If, hypothetically, the power of your mind can heal your sick body, why should you go to the doctor? More importantly, why should you need to buy any drugs? In fact, I was recently chagrined to learn that drug companies are studying patients who respond to sugar pills with the goal of eliminating them from early clinical trials. It invariably disturbs pharmaceutical manufacturers that most of their clinical trials, the placebos, the so-called fake drugs, prove to be almost as effective and occasionally, surprisingly, more effective than their engineered chemical cocktails. Though the drug companies insist that they are not trying to make it easier for ineffective drugs to get approved, it is clear that effectiveness of placebo pills is a threat to the entire pharmaceutical industry. The message from drug companies is clear to me. If you can't beat placebo pills fairly, simply remove the competition. The fact that most doctors are not trained to consider the impact of the placebo effect is ironic, because some historians make a strong case that the history of medicine is largely the history of the placebo effect. For most of medical history, doctors did not have effective methods to fight disease. Some of the more notorious treatments once prescribed by mainstream medicine include bloodletting, treating wounds with arsenic, the proverbial cure-all rattlesnake oil. No doubt some patients, the conservatively estimated one-third of the population, who are particularly susceptible to the healing power of the placebo effect, got better without these, or in fact without any treatment. In today's world, when doctors wearing white collars deliver a treatment decisively, patients may believe the treatment works, and so it does, whether it is a real drug or just a sugar pill. Though the question of how placebos work has in the main been ignored by medicine, recently some mainstream medical researchers are turning their attention to it, often reluctantly. The results of these studies suggest that it's not only a wacky 19th century treatments that can foster a placebo effect, but surprisingly also modern medicine's sophisticated technologies, including the most concrete of medical tools, surgery. A Bayer Bylor School of Medicine study published in 2002 in the New England Journal of Medicine evaluated surgery for patients with severe debilitating knee pain. The lead author of the study, Dr. Bruce Mosley, knew that knee surgery helped his patients. All good surgeons know that there's no placebo effect in surgery. But Mosley was trying to figure out which part of the surgery was giving his patients relief. The patients in the study were divided into three groups. Mosley shaved the damaged cartilage in the knee of one group. For another group, he flushed out the knee joint, removing material thought to be causing the inflammation effect. It should be said that both of these constitute standard treatment for arthritic knees. The third group got fake surgery. The patient was sedated. Mosley made three standard incisions and then talked and acted just as he would during a real surgery. He even splashed salt water to simulate the sound of the knee washing procedure. After 40 minutes, Mosley sewed up the incisions he had done for the surgery, alleged surgery. All three groups were prescribed the same post-operative care, which included an exercise program. The results were actually shocking. Yes, the groups who received surgery as expected improved, but surprisingly, the placebo group improved just as much as the two other groups. Despite the fact that there are some 650,000 surgeries yearly for athletic knees at a cost of about $5,000 each, the results were clear to Mosley. My skill as a surgeon has no benefit on these patients. The entire benefit of surgery for osteoarthritis on the knee was a placebo effect. Television news programs graphically illustrated the stunning results. Footage showed members of the placebo group walking and playing basketball, in short, doing things they reported they could not do before their quote-unquote surgery. The placebo patients didn't find out for 2 years that they had gotten fake surgery. One member of the placebo group, Tim Perez, who had to walk with a cane before the surgery, was now able to play basketball with his grandchildren. He summed up the theme of the book when he told the Discovery Health Channel, "In this world, anything is possible when you put your mind to it. I know that your mind can work miracles." We will continue. We will continue our look at this very interesting book, The Biology of Belief, and continue examining the effect of placebos on a wide variety of medical treatments and interactions to shake our belief in the Newtonian or materialistic view of surgery and of medicine. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.